the World. I'm John Batchelor, welcoming Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, a senior fellow, teaches law at NYU, the University of Chicago, to comment on the recent session of the Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, with regard to the presidency itself in the Constitution and in practice. Richard, a very good evening to you. The two cases at hand are Fisher versus the United States and Trump versus the United States. Turning on the first, Fisher, an interpretation of the Sarbanes-Oxley rules of the early part of this century to do with fraud, especially corporate fraud, in which there's destruction of documents to prevent the correct prosecution or discovery by authority. That's Fisher. And then the Trump versus United States turns on the question of immunity for the serving president of the United States. And they're linked in that the Smith special counsel has brought charges against former President Trump, who is now a candidate for the presidency again, based upon his conduct and stories of his conduct on January 6, 2021, the so-called insurrection. And Mr. Smith, two of the four charges turn on the matter of immunity. In other words, the Sarbanes-Oxley interpretation that those at the Capitol interrupted the course of business, which in fact was a course of the Congress vouchsafing the Electoral College votes that were already delivered to the Congress as do the Constitution, according to the Constitution's calendar. So the Fisher case is linked to immunity only in that they both involve Mr. Trump. The immunity case, however, has now delayed the sentencing in the prosecution in New York City by a district attorney, Bragg. So we've got interlocking matters all turning on Mr. Trump. At the same time, he's now a leading candidate for the presidency in 2025. How do we sort out the court's decision on Fisher and Trump? Good evening to you, Professor.
Good. I think the one word that we have to start with is hubris, as the description of Jack Smith, who is guilty of systematic overcharging. The basic rule of the game that you wish to have when you're dealing with presidential situations, which are completely unprecedented, is you have to be very confident that you're right on the law and very confident that you're right on the facts. And it turns out he can't be confident with respect to either of those two things. So with respect to the law, what you do is you have a compound statute, which was mainly dealing with the destruction of records for financial fraud cases, whereas the savings clause afterwards followed by the word otherwise. And the otherwise then talks about various kinds of influences and activities. And if you read that standing alone, you may be able to say that some of the stuff that was done by either Fisher or by Trump was caught by the statute. But usually, in effect, if you have a statute which has a first part and a savings clause, you don't want the savings clause to be larger than the initial clause and go far off from anything that has to do with Sarbanes-Oxley. This is a case in which you take the title and use that to help construe some of the subordinate provisions. Well, he unmoored the two sections and brought them, and he brought it against a case in which there were terrible facts. It turns out Fisher goes in. He's there for 4 minutes. He may or may not have been jostled by the police or may have jostled them and then leaves. The idea that somehow or other he's part of a massive conspiracy designed to overthrow the United States is a bit preposterous. And they charge him under a statute which allows them to sanction him for many years, when in fact all they had to do, if they were just interested in the neutral enforcement of the law, was charge him with a modest count of criminal trespass. He's in jail for 10 days and he goes home. And I think everybody who kind of sees this has a kind of an intuitive sense that proportionality is an essential feature of the criminal law, and that this was a wildly disproportionate case. And so what happened is, even though it was only, I guess, 5-4, it was clearly the kind of thing in which the only reason why you would sustain the conviction against Fisher was because you knew out of your corner of your eye that it's the same provision that you're using against Trump. But it was an outrageous choice to do that. And then there's, of course, the question of insurrection. Well, they tried that when they had the impeachment hearing, which is a trial, and they lost on that. And our good friend Smith was worried that if he tried to bring another insurrection case, he might be caught by double jeopardy, since they're both criminal proceedings inside the federal system. Not 100% sure, but it's at least a risk. So what he does is he then goes cheap again and takes these very weak counts and starts to put them forward. And again, it's the same point. If you're going after a president on an unprecedented theory, you better be strong on either the rights or the facts. Well, the D.C. Circuit did him an immense favor, because they said anytime a man is running for re-election, it is not part of the official acts. And the Supreme Court Justice Roberts said, wait a second, I don't quite see it that way. And so what he did is he said, I think an official act is anything that the president does, roughly speaking, in the line of his duties. There's a civil case which says we give him absolute immunity from those things. And if you have that in the civil case, well, as Robert said, you got to do it in the criminal case. And then he takes the move, which I think is somewhat doubtful and very controversial. When you start pestering Donald Trump starts to go after Pence and say, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. What happens is, if you read this under the view of the earlier courts, that's an unofficial act because he's just running for re-election. On the other hand, there was also a First Amendment defense. He was basically petitioning the government, and if he didn't use force and fraud against Pence, it's perfectly okay. Roberts took a different line. He says, anytime you speak to another government official when you're in office, that's an official act, and we don't want to look to motive to figure out why you're doing it. So all of a sudden, a knockdown case for the government turns out to be a dead loser. Now, why does this affect everything else, including Mershon, in the way in which he wants to treat people in New York? Well, put it in this fashion. You now have to ask the question, if they're going to give this kind of protection for elections in this case, and if they're going to give the same thing in the case involving Colorado and the insurrection charges being decided by the states, the Supreme Court is telling you, we do not want legal disputes of a rather dubious nature to influence the way in which a general election runs. And so what's going to happen is Mershon has to decide whether or not the spirit of the Trump case on the immunity as president carries over to Trump as a presidential nominee. It wasn't solved, obviously, in the earlier case, but it's hanging out there as a huge situation. And in my view, you should extend the immunity to this case, because you don't want some two-bit case dredged up by a partisan prosecutor having to do with some modest payments 8 years ago to influence the course of a presidential election. And you certainly don't want commentators one after another, including the current president, saying, well, how could you elect a convicted felon when in fact the charges are so really corrupt? So he's postponing this to figure it out, and this is what's going to happen. No matter what he decides, somebody's going to appeal, because it's a very difficult kind of question. And this then goes back, and I'll end right on this point again. You don't start down a road if you're Jack Smith unless you know what's at the end of it. This is not Richard Nixon and the tapes where you had him dead to right if you could start to play them. What you need to do when you prosecute is to make sure that if it were non-president, you'd have a solid case. And the last thing you want to do is to have the prosecution being brought by somebody who works for the incumbent, his rival. And, you know, they say, well, you know, Jack Smith can be fired by Merrick Garland, but only for cause very narrowly defined. And that gives rise to yet another problem. Given the fact that you can't get him except for once in a blue moon for palpable incompetence, he then becomes a superior officer or a principal officer, which means that his appointment may be bad, which is something that's being argued in the Mar-a-Lago case. So this whole thing is a really an amateur hour by a bunch of people who don't know what they're doing. I'm not a criminal prosecutor, but the fact that I can figure out so many ways in which these characters have got it wrong suggests that the guys who are running this situation are really rank amateurs.
In international affairs, this is called lawfare. However, yes. I want to focus on the immunity charge, the immunity claim. There is a process between the three branches of government already in place, which is impeachment and removal from office. That going forward would clear the deck for a criminal prosecution afterwards. Is that not an adequate remedy?
Well, I think that it is. And let's go back and talk about this. One of the things about the semi-hysterical Sotomayor dissent, she did not bring credit upon herself, said, of course, you can't be immune from criminal prosecution. Well, look at it this way. How long did it take when they wanted to gear up to go for Trump on the second impeachment? And it took them 10 days, and off they went. You want to do this through the criminal system. You're talking about 2 to 3 years because you're going to have to bring charges. Then there are going to be all sorts of difficulties on depositions, jury selection, and everything else. And so the criminal prosecution is not a good remedy. If, in fact, you do it the other way and run the impeachment first, which you could do fairly quickly, and then leave it to the rest of the system to figure out what the punishments are after you remove them from office, my view is that it's a better way. All the arguments that have been made in the opposite direction are refuted by the very cases in which they're discussed. The criminal system is not sturdy, quick, and reliable. Given the need, the size of the stakes and the need for various kinds of protection, it's a very long and drawn-out process. Just look at what's happening now. And there's also, you have to remember, there's really abuses that can start to take place. There's nothing which says that the president's always the bad guy when these criminal cases are brought. It could be that the bad guys are the people who are being it. And when you start talking about who's above the rule of the law, the way in which Joe Biden and Merrick Garland have operated in this case, it shows to me that those two together are really a very, as we like to say, serious threat to democracy.
The Chevron case, Professor. Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. The Fisher and Trump case apply to these next months. The Chevron case is forever in my amateur reading when we come back. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.